Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. It's Wednesday, May 16th, 2018, and that means it's time for another New Comics Wednesday episode. I'm going to be talking about a few of the books that caught my eye this week. I read quite a few. I think I'm going to cover, nine books this week. So quite a bit. Decided to do a few more than I normally do because unfortunately, Nick's not able to join me tonight, so running solo. And the first book I'm going to talk about, my book of the week, it's The Dead Hand, number 2, The Creative Team. It's written by Kyle Higgins. We've got art by Stephen Mooney, colors by Jordi Belair. And I actually got a chance to have a quick chat with Kyle about the book, so I'm going to go ahead and play that for you now.
All right, everybody. I have one of my favorite writers joining us to talk about his book. That's the second issue is out today, May 16th. It's Dead Hand number 2, and I have the pleasure of welcoming Kyle Higgins to the show. Kyle, thanks for joining.
Hey, how's it going, man? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. I know you're busy, so we're going to keep this short and sweet. So why don't we start off by telling all the listeners what The Dead Hand is kind of all about?
Well, it's my third. It's my third book at Image. It's creator-owned series. It's kind of an end of the Cold War spy thriller that looks at doomsday weapons that the Soviet Union, some of which the Soviet Union built, some of which they didn't build. The name itself refers to an autonomous weapon system called the Dead Hand that the Soviet Union toyed with the idea of, but never actually constructed. But this is kind of a what if they did scenario in a 6-issue series.
So some of what you're basing the story on is based in actual fact, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the background and the way I kind of ground the situation and the secret cities in the Soviet Union, that's all real. And then it's an extrapolation from there. And I'm being a little coy right now because like there's some twists at the end of the first issue, and then a bigger one at the end of the second issue that comes out on Wednesday that totally tee up and like, oh, this is what the series is. But they're pretty cool moments. So,
yeah, they're really kind of holy smoke moments, definitely. But what made you want to tell this story? It's a little bit of a departure from your previously creator-owned stuff.
you know, Stephen Mooney and I really wanted to work together and wanted to find something that we were interested in, and we both kind of have an affinity for things like, you know, Bond and Metal Gear Solid and Cold War stuff. So it just kind of was born from that. And years ago, probably back in 2014, I started having the idea of like, this could be a cool kind of MacGuffin. And then as I learned more and more about the Perimeter, which was the semi-autonomous weapon system that the Soviets did build, and then the talks about something like the Dead Hand, I just felt like there was a lot there that could be interesting.
Now, you're about the same age I am, so you grew up kind of during the Cold War, and there was always that, you know, specter of nuclear war and the world's going to end. Does that kind of inform the story as well? I mean, is it kind of nice to go back and, you know, explore that menace?
Well, I don't remember any of that. I was born in 85, so by the time I was old enough to really even be aware that that was a thing, it was pretty much over. I mean, the wall fell in 91.
Right.
90 or 91, and then everything kind of officially ended a few months or to a year after that. We didn't learn about something like Perimeter until, I believe, 1993. So I'm fascinated by the specter of like that kind of that great threat that is always out there and present, but it wasn't something that I lived through personally. But conceptually, I've always been really kind of fascinated by it because it there's a lot kind of similar to going on right now, in some ways where you know, we don't really know how this is going to play out. And that ended up being a coincidence that the book, you know, is coming out now, because Stephen and I have been working on it for a couple of years now.
Yeah, it almost seems very, very topical. I was going to mention that. Some are saying that we've got the start of a new Cold War with what's going on with Russia. And there always seems to be a fascination. I mean, there's plenty of us that were alive back then and remembered, and we do seem to be going back down that path. So it's interesting the way things are now. Have you played with that at all? Are you trying to pull that in at all now that it you know, like you said, you've been working on it a couple of years. Was there any changes to the story? You're like, oh, now we can kind of do this and it won't seem so far-fetched.
Oh, just because of our current.
Right.
No. I mean, I've written most of this well before, you know, this administration came into office and before tensions
right.
Really escalated to the level that they are now. But I mean, maybe subconsciously it's in the back of my mind as I write the finale here, the finale of this, you know, at least this arc of it. But it wasn't something that I went into it with a predetermined, idea for.
Right. But you must've been kind of weirded you out a little bit. You're like, you're about to tell this story about, you know, U.S. Russian tensions and, you know, Cold War, and here we are maybe on the verge of another, and then this administration comes in and you're just like, whoa, what's going on?
Right. It's a little bit of a I don't know, it's in the zeitgeist, I guess.
Right.
Like I said, it wasn't planned, but on the flip side, I've gotten completely it's become more relevant right now, I suppose. But on the flip side, right. I've been completely screwed on that on another project when I did Nightwing: The New Order, where I started writing it 2 years before this, you know, administration state of the world. And the idea of an authoritarian, you know, future of the DC universe all of a sudden was widely panned just even conceptually when the book was announced. Now the book has come out and people have read it and see that it's not what their initial reactions were leading them to believe it was, but still, like, I think anytime you get into a heightened era of the world, not of the world, but a heightened era, it's very easy to read into things on any sort of project. And sometimes I think that's valid, and other times it's really just a coincidence of timing.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, sometimes these projects take years and years. I don't think people, you know, realize that. And I think you're drawing from the headline, so to speak, and it turns out not to be that way.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned a couple of the big kind of cliffhangers. You know, we saw a big one in issue one, again in issue two. When you're structuring a story like that, did you have these two big ideas and you say, okay, this is going to be the end of issue one, this is going to be the end of issue two, or was it you know, happen a little more organically? And are you planning on, I mean, can you keep topping yourself as each issue ends?
Yeah, I mean, the rate that you parse out information is something that I really pride myself on, and I absolutely approached the structure of this story with that in mind. I wanted to really hit you with one big kind of twist reveal after another. There are still a few more big ones coming up.
Oh man, I can't wait. you know, I did hear some other people's reactions on, I was totally blown away by issue one. You know, mm-hmm. I've come to expect great things from you and you didn't let me down.
Thanks.
But, you know, some of the people's reactions I thought was, oh, you know, the first half of the book, it seemed a little cliche, maybe, you know, super spy and Cold War. And we've seen that story before, but then he completely flipped it on the end and threw it on its head. I mean, I enjoyed it from the beginning, even without that twist, just because you know, maybe, you know, looking back at my childhood, Cold War, whatever, mm-hmm. but throwing these twists in there, do you ever worry about raising expectations too high and then the climax maybe not?
No, but I appreciate you putting that on my radar so I can be concerned about it now. No, and I didn't know that people, there were, I try to stay away from all that. And you know, everyone's a critic. So I try to stay as far away from that stuff as I can. I don't know. I mean, if I didn't create that, that's the risk and the fear with any project that you write is like, it is constantly a walk between, like, it's a super fine line between expectation and exposure. And most writers are looking and just trying to get their work out there and some exposure on it. And then on the flip side, you have work that sets expectations and there is exposure for it. I've talked about this in some Power Rangers interviews where, like, you know, something like The Dead Hand is a creator-owned book that's hard to cut through the noise and get word of mouth on. Whereas Power Rangers is like, it's going to sell and people are going to buy it. And now there's built-in exposure and that raises the level of expectation. So you vacillate between those two feelings, or at least I do. And on something like this, like, anything you can do to try to get it out there is going to help you, because it's not, you know, creator owned books are tough. It's a tough market. It's a crowded shelf space. So, like, if you're not bringing it, then you best not do it at all.
Right. And I guess at the end of the day, you've got to service the story though, right? I mean, you got to tell the story you want to tell and not worry so much about how people are going to receive it. You know, you hope you have a good story.
In theory, but of course you worry about that stuff. Like, of course it's in the back of your mind. Like, you can drown it out, or you get more comfortable with it being there over the years and the more of these things you do. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a thing that, you know, that you're aware of.
Right. And so we've mentioned that issue 2 comes out today, as you listeners are hearing this. So issue 1, how was the reception for that?
I mean, it was great so far. I mean, I wish the sales were higher, but no, they were, the reaction was pretty great and very surprised by the ending. And yeah, like I said, I try to stay away from some of that stuff.
Right. Yeah, fair enough. And you mentioned your collaborator on the series, Stephen Mooney. Mm-hmm. I mean, his art so perfectly suits
this, right?
Because the story is really being told, like, you know, kind of flashback in the Cold War era and then, you know, modern day. And you talked about him and you wanting to work together for a while. So how did you guys come together and say, this is the project that we're finally going to get a chance to work on? The story we want to tell.
Well, like I said, we wanted to work together. So it became a matter of me finding something that I thought could be cool for us to do together and could speak to some of our shared interests. And so we really just kind of built this together. And I can't say enough positive things about Steven and Jordy Belair, who colors, and Clayton Cowles, who letters this book. I mean, it's really kind of like a super team that I'm working with here. And so a lot of this is me building out in the script, the scenarios and the pages. And then they just kind of take it to a whole other level. Sorry, it's my editor actually. she's going to yell at me about where my pages are, I'm sure. it's, you know, they really take it to a whole other level. And Steve and I have such a shorthand at this point where, like, I'm writing kind of a pseudo plot style for him, where I'm describing I'm writing all the lines of dialogue. But the descriptions are a little sparser, and then Steven fills it out. And then I come back and write final dialogue for it. And he doesn't actually show me layouts anymore. He just does finish inks. And then it's kind of fun. It's like jazz. Like, I get to go in and kind of, if there's big stuff to rework, like, obviously he'll do it. But, like, I like playing with stuff that's there. and then we build the final issue together.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you're talking about almost like a super team here, because, you know, Jordy, in my mind, you know, top colors in the field. Clayton, you know, his work speaks for itself. So it's so great to see you all jamming on this piece. And I mean, you know, I'm a fan of your work, but to me, this is the best thing you've ever done. It's absolutely incredible. So
thanks, man.
I'm going to try to help get the word out. All you listeners, you need to go out there and pick up issue 1 and 2. You won't be disappointed. Incredible cliffhangers. I know you're busy, Kyle, so I'm going to let you go. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners, other projects you want to plug, anything like that?
No, I think that's probably it. I also had a film come out called The Shadow Hours, and you can check it out at theshadowhours.com. It's for free. So I guess I would plug that. And beyond that, there should probably be a couple more things being announced that I'm working on pretty soon here.
All right. Sounds great. And if listeners want to follow along with your work so they know when those announcements come out, where's the best place to follow you on social media?
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram. It's the same name. It's just Kyle D. Higgins.
All right, listeners, and I'll put those links in the show notes so you can go and follow Kyle and check out his work. And again, Kyle, thanks a lot. I'll let you get back to work and hope to talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
You bet. Take care. Thanks again.
Take care.
All right. Again, I want to thank Kyle for joining me. I know he's really busy these days with Power Rangers and his film career and such. So really appreciate you taking the time, Kyle. And as far as the book, you know, you heard it in the interview. I'm a huge, huge fan. And I really think that I'm surprised this book's not getting more buzz, because I think it's really that good. And being that Kyle's a filmmaker, I could see this translating to the screen very easily. And so do yourself a favor, because if that happens, this book's going to pick up a lot of heat. So do yourselves a favor and pick it up, if only for that reason, but really pick it up because it's such a good story. And I would recommend this to anybody who's a fan of Captain America Winter Soldier, because that's kind of the feel that you get. And in fact, I recommended this to Nick when issue 2 came out. We got our preview copies on Friday. I'm like, hey, you need to check out The Dead Hand and issue 1 and issue 2. And because I know what a fan Nick is of the Winter Soldier and Marvel movies in general. He read it and he was completely blown away. So again, it gets my strongest possible recommendation. Book of the week, Dead Hand number 2. Be sure you pick yourself up a copy when you head into the comic shops today. Next book I'm going to talk about is Walk Through Hell number 1. And much like the fact that I had Kyle Higgins to talk about Dead Hand number 2, I recently, on our Aftershock Monday episode this week, got to talk with editor-in-chief of Aftershock, Mike Martz, about A Walk Through Hell. So I really encourage you to go and check out that interview. Gives you a little more of the insight. The only thing I'll add here is this is very much a kind of a setup issue, but there's enough kind of shocking and surprising story beats that it made for a compelling tale, and you really want to see what happens next. But the first issue is a little bit of just getting to know the characters and getting to understand the situation. But there's a scene, I think it's about 4 pages from the end, with the SWAT team in the back of their kind of their SWAT tactical van or whatever. And it's completely blew me away. It's like, whoa, what the heck is going on here? And if you read the book, you'll definitely know what I'm talking about as soon as you see it. So if it wasn't for Dead Hand number 2, I would have picked this as my book of the week. It's a great start to a very subtle horror tale from Garth Ennis. So really recommend you getting out there and picking that up. Speaking of horror books, next book I'm going to talk about is Gideon Falls number 3. This is from writer Jeff Lemire, with art by Andrea Sorrentino and colors by Dave Stewart. This book has been getting a lot of heat. I think issue 1 went to a second printing, and I want to say issue 2 as well. So this is one of those you're going to want to get to your comic shop early and pick up. It's basically the story. There's 2 stories going on, and it centers around this mystical black barn that appears to people and then disappears kind of without a trace. And we don't really understand the origins behind it yet, but there is a guy in New York City who's always had visions of this black barn, and he's obsessed with finding it to the point where he picks up little pieces of trash here and there, what people would just consider garbage, really. But they're actually pieces, supposedly, of this mystical barn. And he's been in and out of mental institutions his whole life because nobody believes him. And at the end of last issue, we saw that his psychiatrist, who is thinking about having him recommitted again because he's having issues, or seems to be having issues, she sees a vision of the black barn. And so in this issue, we get her confronting him about the fact that she's seeing these visions now, and she doesn't really know what to make of it. But Norton, the guy who's seen the black barn his whole life, can't believe that she's still not buying into it. And you can tell she's kind of on the fence about it. You know, she knows, she thinks what she saw was real, but she's doubting herself. And the more she talks about it, the more she's just not sure. So that's one of the stories that's going on. And the other story has to do with the town of Gideon Falls and a new priest that just showed up there, and something going on with the previous priest. So as creepy as the first issue was, and that kind of continued that mood and tone in the second issue, this third issue really advances the plot forward much more than the first two issues. We really get a lot of story here. We kind of start to understand how the priest that's in town, Father Fred, what his role may be. We are introduced to a new character who is in the town who seems to maybe know more about what's going on than anybody else. Doc Sutton is his name. And he may have been working with the previous priest, Father Tom, to try to combat the evil that is the Black Barn. So it seems like now that we've met Doc Sutton, he may be our kind of our POV character, our window into what exactly is going on with this Black Barn. But the story is really, really compelling. A great art by Sorrentino. And this is, if you're looking at, you know, ratcheting up tension, this issue doesn't do that. It's, again, it's more about advancing the story. So my thought is, and what I think is going to happen is the next issue, Lemire's going to crank up the knob again on the tension and the creepiness. It wouldn't surprise me at all. But this has been a really compelling story, and it's one you shouldn't sleep on because it's like I said, getting a lot of buzz. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Jimmy's Bastards number 8. It's the penultimate issue of this super spy comedy tale that's being told by Garth Ennis. Art on this is by Russ Braun, and colors are by John Kalis. So this has been a really, really fun story. Such a stark contrast to A Walk Through Hell in tone. And the only reason I mention that is just because written by the same guy, if I gave you these two books and said, hey, read them, and you had no idea who they're written by, I think you'd have a hard time realizing that they're both written by the same guy. It just goes to show the talent that Garth Ennis has. And in fact, you know, I mentioned earlier the talk I had recently with Mike Martz. He was talking about the fact that Garth is really a jack of all trades. He can write comedy, he can write horror, he can write superheroes. He's just one of those guys. He's a consummate storyteller and just so talented. And so for those not familiar, Jimmy's Bastards is a complete super spy comedy over the top with this James Bond type character named Jimmy Regent, who is like just every cliche in the book, right? Like womanizing, hard drinking, completely capable and to the point of it seeming almost like supernatural, you know, dodging bullets and killing bad guys. And this is definitely a mature book, right? Sexual themes, a lot of blood, a lot of violence, harsh language. So definitely not for kids. But if you're a fan of James Bond, or just a fan of something like The Boys, for example, which was a previous Ennis title, you're going to dig this. It's so, so fun. And Jimmy's really been put to the ringer in this story. So he hasn't quite recovered yet. And if I had any nitpick about the issue, it's that he's not back all the way yet. Like I said, he really gets put through the ringer with the villains he goes up against, and it kind of makes sense. It would kind of knock him for a loop, but he's really kind of swung over to the other extreme where he's still shooting people, but now he's like, sorry. And he's much more timid. He doesn't have that confidence and that swagger and that charm. So, you know, as you read the title, I found myself, as I read it anyway, really rooting for Jimmy and liking him despite all his quirks and foibles and being just really, in a way, not a very nice person. But you can't help but, even though maybe he's a little better person now, he's a little more self-aware, you can't help but root for the return of the over-the-top, completely unapologetic version of Jimmy, because that's the Jimmy that's so fun, right? This Jimmy is much less fun. So it's going to be interesting to see in the final issue, issue 9, how Innes resolves all that. But it's been a heck of a lot of fun. Another title from Aftershock that's hitting on all cylinders. Recommend it for sure. Again, mature readers, though. All right, next up, we have Justice League No Justice number 2. Quite a few writers on this one. We've got Scott Snyder, James Tynan, and Joshua Williamson. The art is by Francis Manapole and Marcus Toe. And then we have colors by Hi-Fi. So this is the second issue of the weekly No Justice series that's kind of coming right out of DC Metal. And then it's going to lead into the new Justice League title written by Scott Snyder, as well as the Justice League Dark and the Justice League Odyssey title. Justice League Dark being written by Tynan, and Justice League Odyssey being written by Joshua Williamson, and Scott Snyder is going to handle the regular Justice League. So basically the premise is at the end of Dark Knight's Metal, we know that the repercussions of that event, the heroes basically broke the source wall when they pulled the Earth back up out of the dark matter multiverse. And so a lot of the powers that be at DC and Scott Snyder himself have described the result of a broken source wall as, think of the entire DC universe that we've known up till now as being contained in a fishbowl. Now imagine if you took a fishbowl and you dumped it inside the ocean, right? That little amount of water into this vast amount of water with so many more creatures, and it'd be hard for that water, that universe that was contained, when it's dumped into this other body of water, this much larger one, it's going to mix and there's going to be different reactions. And quickly, you're not going to be able to identify what that water was that came from the fishbowl. So the universe, or the existence outside the source wall, is that vast ocean. And the DC universe has been exposed to it, been dumped into it, and now we're seeing ramifications of that. So what we saw in the first issue of Justice League No Justice was there are four beings that are like older than our universe that feed on different energies, wisdom, mystery, entropy, and what's the last one? Let me scroll through here real quick and find it. Sorry, I'm just trying to wisdom. Did I say that one? Yeah. Entropy, wonder, mystery, and wisdom. Those are the four energies that these beings feed off of. So they are looking to devour the planet Kolu. And if the superheroes of the Justice League and the other villains that were recruited by Brainiac can't stop Kolu from being destroyed, then the next target is going to be Earth. So the way supposedly this is going to be stopped is by restoring balance to these four different forces, right? Wisdom, entropy, wisdom, and chaos. They need to be equal, so one doesn't outweigh the other. And it's not exactly clear how that's going to stop these planets from being destroyed. but I guess we'll see. And I do have to say that the second issue, it didn't have any kind of oh crap moments the way the first issue did toward the end. We do see, you know, one of the Omega Titans, that's what the ancient beings are called, has arrived on Kolu, and the different teams are trying to figure out how they're going to stop it. And it's interesting. I think that the three writers on the book are doing a good job of keeping it realistic. I mean, these teams don't necessarily get along with each other, their teammates, very well, you know, because it's heroes and villains working together, and that's always going to cause some level of tension. And we do see another Amanda Waller appearance at the beginning of the book. And much like when I was talking about last week, how I just can't stand her. Yeah, she's just as arrogant and bullheaded and bull in a china shop causing problems as ever. She thinks she has a solution on Earth, but that turns out not to quite be the case either. So there's a lot of setup in this issue. I mean, it's kind of action-packed, but it's in a way not much happens. Because it's like each of the teams goes out to their respective trees on Kolu. Now, Kolu is a planet that Brainiac's from. So, you know, they've completely abandoned magic and mystery and entropy or chaos as well. You know, it's a very ordered place. But wisdom is clearly what is the most strong energy there. So the team that goes to the wisdom tree needs to kind of find a way to dial back the wisdom energy while the other three teams are trying to crank up their energy. So it's an interesting concept, but it's like, and the heroes are facing the same problem too. Like, we don't understand, like, okay, so they go to the trees, but how are they supposed to do it? And they don't know that either. That, you know, they comment on like, okay, so we're here, but we don't really know what we're supposed to do. So how are we supposed to balance these out, and what will balancing them out do? Like, so will it just mean that the Omega Titan that feeds on wisdom won't come and devour the planet because the planet won't have a bunch of wisdom energy because everything will be balanced? Like, none of that is clear necessarily. And so I don't know if that's a failing of the story. I think it's one of those things, it may be we won't know until the end of the story how it all like works together. So being that it's a weekly series, at least we don't have to wait very long before we find out. But it is an interesting concept. As far as the art goes by Manipul and Toe, it's okay. It's not like spectacular. There are some pretty big spreads. But again, I've said this so many times about Manipul's art. I loved it when he first burst on the scene, but now that he has a little bit more of a like a watercolor quality, I just don't enjoy his art as much. I can't fault his storytelling, though. Uses a lot of close-ups, though. I will say that. But dynamic panel layouts and compelling enough read. But if you aren't reading this, it's not one I'd say that's a must read. Like, if you just plan on picking up the Justice League book when it starts with issue one, I think you'd be fine. Or if you just plan on reading a Justice League Odyssey or Justice League Dark, I think, or all, you know, one or two or all three, whatever your preference, I think you don't necessarily need this to understand what's going on. I'm pretty sure that, being that the three writers on those titles are the same three writers here, that they're going to give enough of a recap and kind of fold it into their first few issues that you're going to understand what's going on here. So just my thought. Next up, we have The Wildstorm, number 13. I have to put that in the show notes here. And this is written by Warren Ellis with art by John Davis Hunt and colors by Steve Bucciolato. And again, I've talked about Wildstorm on the podcast before. If you're a fan of the old Wildstorm stuff and you're expecting the old Wildstorm stuff, that is not what this is. This is a complete reimagining of the Wildstorm universe by Warren Ellis. I never read a lot of that old Wildstorm stuff. So for me, it's not confusing. It's not, you know, the characters are here. Like in this particular issue, we get John Lynch and we get Mark Slayton, who was Backlash. Backlash in the original Wildstorm. But they're recognizable, but they are different. They are really different. And the whole idea behind the Wildstorm universe is the same but slightly changed, right? This is more of a grounded conspiracy, political, super spy kind of take on the universe rather than a superhero take. So I've heard some people complain, some longtime Wildstorm fans that loved the original Wildstorm stuff that Jim Lee created, and they haven't liked this. But I think they're nostalgic for the old stuff that used to be. And that's not what this is trying to be. But what this is a really compelling story with interesting characters and incredible art by John Davis Hunt. If you haven't seen John Davis Hunt's art, you are missing out. His art is so clean, so expressive. I think he's one of the best storytellers that's working in comics right now. The colors by Steve Bucciolato are done well, a little bit primary, which is fine, but it suits the book really, really well. But again, Hunt's, the way he lays out the panels, the action within the panels is so expressive, and it adds to the storytelling so much. There's nothing about this story, this version of the Wildstorm universe that I don't like. It's been a great story. I don't know how the sales are doing. I haven't heard a lot about it. I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it. So I think it might be flying under the radar a little bit. But again, I think it's absolutely incredible. And it's a finite series. It only goes for 24 issues. So it's basically 2 years. And again, I just think the art, the story, absolutely incredible. It's one of those that, even though it's only on issue 13, I think I've gone back and read from start to finish like twice, and I plan on doing another one. Because I read 13, but there was a few things I was a little fuzzy on because they took a month off between 12 and 13. So I read 13, but I'm like, man, I need, now that 13's come out, I need to go back and start over. Because I think when 8 or 9 came out, like I was reading each issue as it came out. And then when 9 came out, I went back and I reread 1 through 8 and then read 9. And now that 13's come out and with that month break, I think I need to go back again and just read 1 through 13, like in one sitting, and get a big chunk of the story, because man, it's so enjoyable. And again, the art by John Davis Hunt, I just can't express how amazing it is. I need to get a commission from him for sure. And I think the only reason that you're not hearing that name, you're not hearing John's name a little more, is because, again, this isn't a mainstream DC title. But if you put this guy in a mainstream DC title, his name would be blowing up everywhere. Like great cover artist, great storyteller. Really, really great art. Up next, we have The Brave and the Bold, number 4. Speaking of great art, the writer of this series and artist, he's doing both, double duty, is Liam Sharp, and the colors are by Romulo Fajardo Jr. So this is a Celtic mystery, if you will. It's rooted in ancient Irish like folklore, and it has to do with kind of a fairy realm and two different races or kingdoms that live there, and they've kind of been at war forever, so to speak, and one of their leaders is assassinated, and Wonder Woman is pulled in to help keep the peace, and she in turn recruits Batman to solve the mystery of who's behind the death of this beloved leader. And in this issue 4, we get a lot of story progression into some possible motivations behind why this king was killed, as well as Batman discovering that an ancient artifact has been stolen. So it's an interesting story. This is one that I think is going to read very well in the trade, just because it's so dense. So it's something I think needs to be read like all in one sitting, or, you know, at least consecutively, rather than, you know, one a month with other comics that you're reading in between, and then you kind of forget what's going on. But I can't wait. I mean, I'm reading it as it comes out monthly. But again, I think that when issue 6 comes out, I'll probably read issue 6 because I want to know the resolution. But then I'll probably immediately go back and read 1 through 6 in one sitting, because again, I think you're going to get so much more out of it that way. And that's just story wise, right? I mean, people hear Liam Sharp and they immediately think artist, but this guy's a great, great storyteller as well. But where he really, really shines is the art. I mean, I've said it, you know, 1,000 times now, but Liam's art transcends comic art and approaches fine art. His level of detail, his line work, the way he expresses emotion, the way he lays out a page. I mean, so interesting, different looking designs on the page, a lot of Celtic endless knots, a lot of intricate design work in the backgrounds, interesting ways of laying out panels, you know, circles and panels framed differently than you'd normally see. I mean, and in this particular issue, we see Wonder Woman and Batman kind of touring this almost like an art gallery that one of the castles has. And the way that artwork is displayed, it's almost like watercolor that's framed with Liam's like regular pencil work. And oh man, is it just gorgeous to look at. I mean, Liam is just outdoing himself here. It's a incredible way to tell a story. And if you're not reading this and checking out this art, I mean, this is a modern master at work. There's no doubt of that. And the story is compelling too. Can't wait to see where it goes and find out who's behind the mystery and who killed the king. So we'll find that out in another couple issues. But in the meantime, man, this art, so incredible. And I really like also how he portrays and characterizes Wonder Woman as very regal, maybe more so than I've seen anyone else do. And I kind of enjoy that. And whereas it's a strong contrast to the way he portrays Batman, very stoic, very reserved, but yet like kind of brutal when he needs to be, right? And very much a thinking man's Batman. So loving the characterization, and especially loving the art. So kudos, Liam, you're doing a great job, man. Okay, up next, I'm going to talk about the Superman Special number 1, written by Peter J. Tomasi, Patrick Gleason, Mark Russell. And there should be, I think I missed one. Sorry, stand by. Because this issue actually has 3 stories in it, and I think I forgot to write down who did the 3rd story. So let me just get there really quickly. Yeah, the 3rd story is by Ian Flynn. Apologies for that, Ian. Certainly didn't mean to leave you out. The art on the issue, Scott Godlewski handles the art in the 1st story, Brian Hitch the 2nd, and Kari Andrews the 3rd. And colors, we have Gabe Eltab on the 1st story, Alex Sinclair on the 2nd, and then Kari colors his own work on the 3rd. So the 1st story was by far my favorite. It's harkens back to Superman issues 8 and 9, when John and his dad, Superman, went to Dinosaur Island and met with Captain Storm of the Losers. And this is basically the return to that island, kind of following up on their desire to bring Captain Storm home. So it was a lot of fun. And usually stories like this, you know, they go back to Dinosaur Island, rescue Captain Storm, and that would be the end of it, right? What I love about this is that's not where the story ends. It's really, in a way, it's where it kind of begins, because it starts talking about Captain Storm, like what his impressions are of the modern world, things he still wants to accomplish, you know, him wanting to return the dog tags of his fallen comrades to their families, And so we get kind of the aftermath and the emotional repercussions of the first part of the story and bringing Captain Storm back. The artwork by Scott Godlewski is really, really well done. There are a couple of really big double page spreads that are awesome. I mean, you got Superman, you've got Captain Storm firing off his guns, you got bullets flying everywhere, you've got dinosaurs. I mean, come on, man. It's just really, really great work by him and Gabe Eltab in the first issue. So, or first story, rather. So that one was a whole heck of a lot of fun. And just like they've done the entire time, Tomasi and Gleason do an incredible job of showing the close relationship, the father and son dynamic between Superman and John Kent. So always love that. And it's something I'm definitely going to miss with Brian Michael Bendis coming on to the Superman title. The second story is probably my least favorite, the one that's written by Mark Russell. It's got Brian Hitch on art. And again, I'm just not a fan of Brian Hitch's art. I have a hard time understanding like why so many people dig his art so much. I mean, he does tend to be very widescreen, so to speak, very cinematic. But I just don't care for his rendering very much. I find his figures, especially faces, to look really odd. That being said, the last page where Superman's in silhouette and you can kind of see the sun setting, I think it looks like it's setting like right over his shoulder, and some great color work there by Alex Sinclair. That page, that scene is very, very well done. But again, it's mostly buildings and Superman in silhouette. I mean, kudos to him for the layout, but there's no face to look weird. So that's probably why I enjoy it so much. The story itself by Mark Russell, it was okay. Kind of had a little bit of trouble with it. I mean, Superman bleeds at one point in the story, and I'm just like, it doesn't really make sense. So I don't know. It was just okay. It almost seemed like Russell was trying to tug at our heartstrings and have it be like super emotional, but with the art being, for me, you know, not very good, it kind of pulled me out of the story. I just didn't feel the impact I think that Mark Russell was hoping to feel. So I don't know, it was a little heavy-handed in my opinion. Definitely not my favorite. The third story stars Superman and the Atomic Skull. Maggie Sawyer makes an appearance. We've seen the Atomic Skull recently kind of turn over a new leaf and he's actually working with the MCU. So that's kind of at the heart of the story. He still holds, you know, some bitterness towards Superman and doesn't know if he can trust him. Superman, for his feelings, it's kind of mutual. He doesn't know that he can trust the Skull, but he gives him the benefit of the doubt, and it proves to be fortuitous, I guess you'd say, in the long run. Skull holds up his end. But what's interesting about this one is at the end, the last panel says, "The end?" question mark. So I don't know if we're going to get more Atomic Skull and Superman or not. But I am glad that this Superman special got to touch base again on what's going on with the Atomic Skull. But what I was going to say is actually it says not the end is what the last panel says. The art on this one by Kari Andrews, really, really well done. Love the way he draws Skull and colors him as well. He's very purple rather than the previous like green and yellowish version. So it'll be interesting to see if Bendis picks up any of the pieces of Atomic Skull and has him in his run going forward, because with him trying to turn over a new leaf but still kind of holding a grudge, makes for an interesting character, right? There's kind of some gray area there. And the last book I'm going to talk about is the last of the DC New Age of Heroes medal, spinning out of the DC medal event. It's New Challengers, written by Scott Snyder and Aaron Gillespie. We've got pencils by Andy Kubert and inks by Claus Janssen, with colors by Brad Anderson. So it's a new take on the Challengers of the Unknown. Scott Snyder helped plot it, and then Aaron Gillespie, who is a an alumnus of the DC Writers Workshop, handles most of the heavy lifting. And this one started out really, really strong, like for the first three or four pages. And then as we started to get further into the story, it started to feel a little cliche, like a story we've seen before. That's not to say it doesn't seem interesting. Basically, these versions of the Challengers, and supposedly all versions of the Challengers, are people that were dead. And upon their death, they're transported to Challenger's Mountain. And they get this tattoo or this brand that's an hourglass. And as long as they're in the mountain, the time doesn't run out on the hourglass. But whenever they, as soon as they leave the mountain, the time starts running out. So the only way to stay alive is to make sure they complete their missions and return to Challenger's Mountain. And there's a, kind of a guide or a person that's giving them the information. They refer to him as the professor. He's the one that tells them about the previous versions of the Challengers, tells them that they need to go and perform their missions or they'll die. And at the end, we get the impression that there's some larger conspiracy, larger reason for him recruiting the particular Challengers that are on the team now, because it seems like there's like some kind of sentient computer or AI that he communicates with, and that AI expresses concerns over the level of capability, I guess you'd say, level of experience of the members that this professor has most recently recruited. But he says, well, you know, I picked them because we're approaching the end game and I need an unconventional approach. So he seems to have picked these specific people for a reason, even though they have personality types that may be a little harder to control. So that's intriguing. Again, it's issue one of a 6-issue limited series. Very intriguing. Not quite as good as I was hoping. And, you know, again, the first few pages were exceptional. And then it kind of fell down into some like tropes and cliches. But I'm willing to give Gillespie a pass on that because, you know, this is his first work. So I'm definitely going to be in for the series. And it looks really interesting. I'll say that for it. So, all right, let me do a quick rundown of some of the other titles I think you should be on the lookout for today. From Aftershock, I talked about two of the three, Jimmy's Bastards number 8 and A Walk Through Hell number 1. In addition, we also have Cold War number 4 from Christopher Sabala with art by Hayden Sherman. Over at Aspen Comics, we've got Journey Volume 3 and number 3 from J.T. Krull. Over at Boom, we have Fence number 6 from DC, in addition to the a few of the titles I mentioned. We also have Batman number 47, which I believe is the second part of the Booster Gold story that's going on with Batman. We've also got a Dark Days, The Road to Metal hardcover for $29.99. Over at IDW, we have Star Trek, The Next Generation Through the Mirror number 3. From Image, we have Barrier number 3. So just real quick on Barrier from Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin. Issue 1 came out on Free Comic Book Day. Then the following Wednesday, which would have been last Wednesday, the 9th, they had a more deluxe version of number 1 hit stands, as well as number 2. So if you didn't pick up, I think a lot of people didn't pick up 2 because they thought it was just a different cover for the better edition of issue 1, right? And they're waiting for issue 2. That's not the case. Issue 2 did come out last week along with the better edition of issue 1. Issue 3 is out this week. Issue 4 and 5 to follow the two subsequent weeks. This is never going to be collected, according to what Image has said. So if you are wondering about this story, if you're curious, you need to be picking it up because it's basically a 5-issue story that's released on 5 consecutive Wednesdays, and when it's gone, not to be collected. So just want to make sure everybody knows that. We also have Black Magic Volume 2 from Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott. It's been an incredible series. Keep threatening about doing a spotlight on that. Haven't gotten around to it yet, but do want to at some point. We also have Curse Words number 14 from Charles Soule and Ryan Brown. Gideon Falls number 3 I mentioned, but there's a third printing of Gideon Falls number 1 coming out today, as well as a second printing of number 2. So if you missed out on issues 1 or 2, you can pick up those subsequent printings today as well. We also from Image have Wicked and the Divine number 36. I haven't read that book, but I've heard nothing but good things about it, so I wanted to be sure and mention it. From Marvel Comics, we have Avengers number 2. We have Captain America 702, Daredevil 602, and the next chapter of The Hunt for Wolverine, Claws of the Killer number 1, also in comic shops today, as well as the next part of the Infinity Countdown story with Infinity Countdown Daredevil number 1. We also have Quicksilver No Surrender number 1. That spins out of the recent Avengers No Surrender storyline. And also the X-Men Wedding Special number 1 that has some new material by Chris Claremont, the legendary X-Men writer who really was the architect of the relationship between Kitty Pryde and Colossus, who are going to be tying the knot very, very soon. And then finally, from Valiant, we have Bloodshot Salvation number 9 and Ninja K number 7. And I talked about those two Valiant books in more depth on the last episode of Valiant Sunday, this last Sunday. So if you want more details on those two books, you can go and check those out there. So that's going to do it for this episode. As always, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us there. Twitter.com/TheComicSource is where we can be found on Twitter. All three spots are great places to follow along when we release new episodes, as well as all of our convention coverage. This weekend, I'm going to be in Ontario, California for the Comic-Con Revolution show. Track me down there. I will have some special giveaways. Just come up, introduce yourself. I love meeting listeners, so... I think that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.